Our second case today is case number 55950, Perez versus State. Mr. Arroyo for the appellant, Mr. Giacomo for the respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Robert Arroyo. Myself and Jonelle Thomas represent the appellant, Angel Arturo Perez. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Why don't you start off with the Brian Rose case and tell us how Brian Rose case affects this case.
All right. I think what Rose is controlling in this case, in Rose, this court placed further limitations on the use of second-degree felony murder, being that assaultive-type crimes cannot be the predicate felony for second-degree felony murder because homicides necessarily include all batteries, assaults within them. So the crime, assault, battery, they merge into the homicide. In this case here, the state pled that the second-degree felony murder, the same that was at issue at Rose, that it was predicate crimes of battery with deadly weapon, assault with a deadly weapon, and discharging a firearm from a vehicle. Now, in Rose, this court said that it is up to the jury to determine what is assaultive-type crime. And in Rose, the predicate offense was assault with a deadly weapon. This court held that the jury could have determined that assault with a deadly weapon is an assaultive-type crime. And I would submit that the same is here. The jury was instructed in this case that assault is intentionally placing another person in reasonable apprehension of immediate bodily harm, which was the same issue at Rose, the same jury instruction at Rose. So they could have found that assault was an assaultive-type crime here. And in regards to the battery with deadly weapon, the jury was instructed that battery with a deadly weapon is willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another with use of a deadly weapon. I would submit that that is definitely a case that the jury could have determined that it was an assaultive type crime that is involved threat of immediate injury. So based on those two, it would be error. And also from the discharging firearm from a vehicle, in Rose, this court said that it is how the crime is committed. So basically, jury has to determine, is it assaultive? Does it involve the threat of immediate injury in the way that it was actually committed? And in this case, it was pled that they discharged the firearm from the vehicle at the group of men across the street, the victims in this case. So in this case, it was involving the threat of injury. They were shooting at those victims. So under Rose, this would be error for the jury not to be instructed that assaultive type crimes merge and can't be the predicate felony.
Could it be harmless?
No, as that was the second part is, it is subject to the harmless error review. And as in Rose, this court held that it was not harmless, basically because there was conflicting evidence at the mind state of the defendant. And in this case, there was conflicting evidence as to Perez's mind state. And that was his entire defense, that he didn't have the requisite mental state for murder at the time that he shot. His defense was that he was acting to a perceived threat, but these instructions allowed him to be convicted under aiding and abetting in the co-defendant Ayala's crimes. There's some of that other evidence that there was that Perez was actually responding to a threat and was not did not have the requisite mind state for just a straight second-degree murder, was the fact that the testimony was that when he first approached Mike Pierre for this transaction of drugs, that he the conversation was actually polite between the defendants and Mike Pierre. And the testimony was Mike Pierre actually is the one that gets hostile and aggressive first. His testimony was that he was confident and aggressive, and he told the defendants, get the F out of here. I'm with my boys across the street. And then when he takes off, he actually goes and talks to his friends, gets out the car and motions back. So for Perez's view, he could have taken this as a threat and as that, Mike Pierre went over back to get his friends. And there was additional testimony that Perez didn't see very well and had just been shot 2 months prior to this event. So he was kind of on edge, on nerves. And lastly, the evidence shows that Perez was actually inside the SUV when the first shots were fired. So in his defense was he didn't know where the shots were coming from. He was really just responding to that perceived threat. And there was substantial evidence to support that theory. So in this case, the state cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this error did not contribute to the verdict in this case.
Well, didn't you actually prevail on the Fox defense or the diminished capacity because he was convicted of second degree instead of first degree?
I don't think it's a non-issue, is what
I'm trying to say. Is it an issue, really?
The Fox defense...
Fox defense can reduce first degree to second degree because of mental
problems. I think it goes a little bit beyond that. He wanted Paglini to testify that he what his mental state was then. He could have testified that he was actually, you know, responding to a threat and that he didn't have the express malice, which is that express or deliberate intent to kill, or that he wasn't really being reckless, but he was protecting himself. He believed in that situation that he needed to protect himself against that threat. So I don't think just the fact that he was convicted of second-degree murder makes that issue moot at this point. Paglini's testimony still should have came in to give that ultimate issue, which is allowed in Nevada under the Alford case.
What about the Miranda issue?
On the Miranda issue, Perez asked the court to suppress his statement based upon that it wasn't knowing and intelligent, and also it was involuntary.
Now, he was, 16 at the time of this, yes, this happened?
He was 16 at the time that this happened. Dr. Paglini testified during trial that he had a very low IQ. I think that placed him in the second to fifth percentile.
How was it? Was he fluent in English, though?
No, he actually moved here. The testimony was in the fifth grade. He was from Mexico, so Mexico was his first language. And the testing showed that when he first got here, he was already behind. So not only did he have the language barrier, he was already behind academically. So we never really caught up. Dr. Paglini's testimony was that he was severely impaired on reading comprehension, verbal comprehension. And this shows in the transcript. If you read the transcript, he doesn't understand that he has a right to have a parent there. And what was read to him was that he has the right to the presence of an attorney, and if one can't be afforded, one will be appointed to you. Now, to us here, that we understand presence, appointed, but when you look at the way that Angel Perez responded, I don't have the quote right now, but I will get it, but he's saying, I want my father to be right here beside me. You could tell in his English that his level of comprehension was severely limited. So
what should the police do in that case, though? I mean, they have an obligation to question this young man.
Yes, and
what can they do?
Well, the question, I think they should take the necessary steps to make sure he understood his rights. Obviously, they were aware that he was having trouble understanding his right to a parent as they went and made sure that his parent was there. But I think the relevant inquiry isn't on the police's duty. It falls upon the judge to decide whether or not the waiver was knowing and intelligent. So as the gatekeeper, it's really the judge's responsibility whether or not the statement comes in. I don't know if we're requesting a rule that the police have any additional duties. The focus is on the defendant, the defendant's education, experience, and whether or not he knowingly and intelligently waived his rights.
Was some of his statement inculpatory?
Yes, his statement that was admitted was that he was part of the conspiracy to rob the black car, that he went up to take a look at it, he thought about robbing it, also that he was wearing a blue bandana, which condemned him as one of the perpetrators.
Let me ask the other half then. Was any of it exculpatory?
There was that he shot at a red car, which could have been a perceived threat. The problem is that he didn't get the instruction that he asked for on his self-defense. On the fact that he did request a self-defense instruction on this case that was denied. I believe there were seven different self-defense instructions. And for the reasons I was explaining on harmless error, there was substantial evidence that he was acting towards a perceived threat, and it's enough to meet the standard that any evidence, no matter how weak or incredible. So without that self-defense instruction, He was very limited in presenting a defense. If you look at the closing arguments, state, acknowledges, hey, there was some talk of self-defense, but you don't have a self-defense instruction in front of you. So by law, any shooting done has to be unlawful. So the jury didn't have a way to determine that Perez's actions were lawful. I think I'm just about 5 minutes.
Almost. Yeah, you're at 5 minutes right this second.
If there's no questions, I'd like to reserve it for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Roy, Mr. DiGiacomo. And you know what we're looking for. We're looking for your explanation of differentiating the Brian Rose decision that the panel, the Southern panel made, and the Miranda issue. If you could just key on those to start off with and then have at it as to anything else you want to say.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the state of Nevada in this particular case. Those are the two issues that I'd like to address for the court, but I want to set a background just briefly.
Certainly.
This is a case involving four individuals where, despite the brief in this particular case, there's no real dispute that three of them get together, they put up their masks, they go to carjack somebody, the guy drives away, and the three of them walk back to the car, and according to Mr. Perez, Mr. Ayala says to Mr. Perez, hey, let's shoot, and they all decide to start shooting over at the guy who's saying, hey, those guys over there are trying to jack me. And a bystander, a friend, who wasn't part of any of this, winds up getting shot and killed. And when you go through the allegations, and I'm going to do Miranda first, but when you go through the allegations and what they say in their brief, it doesn't really conform to the record. For example, they say there's no evidence that Mr. Perez was the shooter outside of the car. Well, the witness says, I see two shooters outside the car, and I see the one in the dark clothing get into the right rear passenger of the vehicle, and that's where Mr. Perez is, and that's where he's identified as being. And the other person gets in the left rear, that's Mr. Ayala, the two individuals who are outside the vehicle that were shooting in that first volley. You can go to their Miranda issue. They say, well, he had a low IQ and he was really drunk, is two of the things that went to that. Well, the motion to suppress was done, and there was no mention in their motion to suppress or the argument on their motion to suppress in December, right before the trial date, that the defendant had a low IQ. The only evidence that there was alcohol is that the defendant himself said he drank some alcohol and smoked some marijuana earlier in the day, but the officer noted no indication of that whatsoever. The argument on the motion to suppress in front of the district court was that when the father got down there, the cop said something to the father, and somehow that might be relevant, but when the defense conceded that the father never conveyed anything that the cops said to him, to Mr. Perez, that it wasn't relevant to the motion to suppress, and the court denied it. First day of trial comes up, and I say, hey, they've noticed an expert on the state of mind of the defendant, and that's when they provide, they say, yeah, we're just calling Dr. Paglini for low IQ, and maybe something else if we have a foundational basis for it. And I've heard the defense here assert to the court that somehow I precluded them from presenting an expert to testify to the state of mind of the defendant. I didn't. I told the court, look, I'd file a motion that he can't say on this day, at this time, the defendant did not premeditate and deliberate his crime, but certainly he can get up there and testify, hey, you know, people who drink, these are the normal effects of drinking, people who smoke marijuana. And Alford says you can't exclude the expert, and I know they like to cite that, but if you actually go to what an expert can say, you go to Juarez, you go to the footnote in Pineda, you go to In re Assad, an expert can't say that is what his state of mind was on a particular occasion during a crime. That's not the subject of expert testimony.
But isn't that argument all moot because he prevailed? I mean, he got the second degree, which he would get with voluntary intoxication or a Fox defense. So he got the second degree. Isn't it moot?
Yeah, absolutely, it's moot and it's harmless, and that's where I want to go, and that's kind of leading me into to Brian Rose.
Well, before you get to Brian Rose, I had asked Mr. Roy, is there anything more the police should do in a situation like this when you're dealing with a juvenile and supposedly lower intelligence type thing?
You can answer straight no if you want.
I mean, despite the accusation of the defense, the police actually did more than they needed to do in this particular case. The problem Mr. Perez had was, hey, am I going to jail? Yeah, you're going to jail. Okay, well, if I'm going to jail, then, you know, I don't want to wait around for my father to show up to talk to you because it's going to be a really long time. So just take me. And they said, no, we'll call him right now on the phone and we'll get him down here. He was confused about the timing, which a lot of defendants are. It has nothing to do with the 16-year-old defendant about you know, will I have to wait? Do I have to go to jail now? And so because he says, well, no, I want to do it right away, the detective says, well, look, let me just make sure we're absolutely clear. You know, the other defendants have asked for their parents to be present, the juveniles. We've gotten them, essentially, their parents coming down. We'll call your dad. We'll get him down here. And, you know, he could be present for the interview. And then they waited until the father showed up, and they did it. So I'm not sure what else they were supposed to do. They had no indication that Mr. Perez, who has had prior criminal contact with the police, who had received Miranda warnings before, who had no indication that he didn't speak perfectly good English, and no indication that he didn't understand the warnings. He just didn't understand the procedure to be followed should he choose to have his father there, and they wanted to clear that up. So I don't think there's anything else the police could have done, let alone that they should have done. If that answers the question, I guess I'll move to Brian Rose, because ultimately, whatever the court decides, it's got to be harmless. But I guess, and unfortunately, I don't have Justice Douglas here, but I know Justice Pickering did sign the opinion, because I have read Brian Rose a number of times. And what my concern with Brian Rose is this question. And the question that I can't answer is, what fact do I have to prove as a prosecutor, or if I'm a citizen on the street, what fact is it that makes the merger doctrine apply? And what I mean, Justice Terry, is before Brian Rose came out, my understanding of the law was this. We have open murder in the state of Nevada. We have first-degree murder, which is either express malice or an enumerated felony. We have second-degree murder, which is basically implied malice. Either you intended to do harm or you had reckless disregard of your social duty under the malice aforethought instruction.
But the better instruction that I think Mr. Lally and some of the other prosecutors use is all other murder is second-degree murder. And usually you press real hard on first-degree, and then if you get lucky as a criminal defense attorney, yes, sometimes I was lucky, sometimes I wasn't, you'd get second-degree. So right. Did you really need this instruction, in the fact, to confuse the jury on merger
and that
battery, I mean, and assault?
I'll be honest with you, I mean, that may in fact be true. Like, is the instruction, particularly like in the Brian Rose case, where the Brian Rose instruction affected it, in this particular case, would an instruction that says if you determine it's assaultive, it's, you know, it's not the second-degree felony murder, but it may be the implied malice murder, I mean, how that would affect it is a whole different question. But I have a broader question, which is, you know, involuntary manslaughter is defined as an unintentional killing. In all of our case law, Barton and the cases before that say, basically what we exclude from involuntary manslaughter is implied malice murder. And the way we exclude it is by saying if the act was naturally tends to destroy human life or the act was felonious, then that is implied malice murder. So when the defense had always argued, and when they argued in this case, that if there's a merger, my argument was there's no merger because it's not like we have, like California's, this is what first-degree murder is, this is what second-degree murder is, this is what involuntary is. We have open murder. It's a set of facts, and those facts are either going to be first, implied, or if it's accidental without felonious intent or not, naturally tending to destroy life, it's involuntary, and then we have the provocation for voluntary. And so in Brian Rose, the answer was he had a gun, he pointed the gun. If he put her in immediate bodily fear of immediate bodily injury, that was a felonious assault. And so thereafter, the gun was discharged and it killed her. And so my question was, okay, well, what fact means that this is implied malice murder versus what fact makes it involuntary murder? And that's not answered in Rose. And juries are supposed to take the facts, decide what the facts are, and apply it to the law. Well, as a lawyer, I can't tell you if the gun is unloaded or he thought the gun was unloaded, but it was accidentally loaded, and the gun went off. Did he intentionally pull the trigger? Is that the determining factor? Or did the gun accidentally discharge and he intentionally pulled the trigger and he thought it was empty? What fact is it? And if the answer to that is, well, did he have a reason to know that the gun was loaded? Well, then the analysis should have been what you guys have said in La Bastida and those cases, which is the crime itself inherently dangerous? So the jury could say, okay, is it inherently dangerous to point a weapon you believe to be unloaded? And we can make a determination, is that inherently dangerous or not? Is it inherently dangerous to point a gun you know is loaded? And so it, because of the inherently dangerous factor, which you give in the involuntary manslaughter to second, that's how you get to the answer. But the answer I read in Rose is, well, was the act assaultive? And I got to tell you, Mr. Lawley's here because Mr. Lawley read your opinion backwards, that if it's assaultive, then it's applied malice murder, and if it's not assaultive, then it's whatever it is. Well, that's not what Rose says. It flips that backwards. And so I don't know how to instruct my jury. I've had a similar case. I talked to the defense attorneys, and ultimately, thank God we dealt it, but neither one of us could come up with how do we instruct a jury that says, you know, if it's assaultive, and what do we mean by it's assaultive, and what fact makes a difference for the defendant? And it's why we sought rehearing, and it was denied, and for whatever reason, we didn't seek en banc, because that's the question we need answered. The question for us is, what fact as a prosecutor do we prove, and what does the normal citizen on the street have notice of? Because I don't know right now if I take my weapon and point it at somebody and it discharges and kills them, what crime I've committed. And I don't know how to tell anybody what crime I've committed from that analysis that Justice Douglas did in Rose. And so I would just ask the court to give us some direction or some understanding, because to me, there's no harm here. Because if a jury says he intended to assault that person, put him in reasonable fear, and we thought it was an inherently dangerous assault, which is the two requirements of assault. In this particular case, there is no issue because, I mean, he acknowledges he was shooting at those people, and so obviously that's an inherently dangerous act. Then that should have been the analysis that Brian Rose got, right? It should have been, the instruction should have been, did you find that his pointing of the weapon was inherently dangerous to the life of the victim? And if you find it's both assaultive, or assault with a deadly weapon, and it was inherently dangerous, then it's implied malice murder. If you find it was assault with a deadly weapon, felonious, but it wasn't inherently dangerous for whatever reason, and you could argue for whatever those reasons are, like he thought the gun wasn't loaded, or you know he checked the chamber, but he was just wrong, or whatever, then that's not a felony which would qualify it as a act which is has reckless disregard to human life or social duty or the other definitions of implied malice. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from, is because as a prosecutor, I don't know how to instruct the jury. I don't know how to deal a case. I don't even know necessarily, you know, if you looked at the opinion, it seemed to me like the court was saying he committed second degree murder because it was assaultive. And so it should have been implied malice murder, but then you reversed the conviction because it wasn't harmless. So you're saying that maybe it was, involuntary manslaughter. And so from an intellectual standpoint, I can't conceptualize what the court wants us to say. I do understand that the court has a concern of prosecutors utilizing a rule with consequences for individuals broader than what the legislature intended. And I think there is a remedy to that, and I think that maybe we've been lax in utilizing the inherently dangerous standard in anything other than in the child baby death cases where we're charging a neglect and asking the jury, is the neglect inherently dangerous? I mean, I think there is a way to solve the problem, but as we all learned from Byford and a number of other cases where the court decided to kind of create new law, the Ninth Circuit, what are they going to do with every defendant who's argued merger now in the last 20 years with our second-degree felony murder rule? And are we going to wind up retrying those even if we say, no, that's a prospective rule or it's not a prospective rule? The harm that was created or the unintended consequences of Brian Rose is beyond comparison. I don't know. Not just on future cases, but in the past, how it affect us. So let's talk about harmless error. Even if you read Brian Rose, I think what the court's concern was potentially Mr. Rose didn't know the gun was loaded, was not even intending to threaten the life of or put her in a reasonable apprehension. And because of that, the concern was that the jury got clouded from it really may have been an accident. And he got convicted of second-degree murder, and there's a harm there that you wanted to solve as a court. And the way you did it was through, in this particular case, there isn't any worry in the world. This entire case was, did they commit first? degree murder, or did they commit second degree murder? And to, although they take me to task when they say that I somehow hid my theory of the case, actually it was the opposite. The defense was saying in the record, well, look, I know we still can't get around the felony murder robbery. And I'm the one who had to say, no, 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 you guys don't understand. Because of our case law, an attempt robbery ends when the guy, when they don't take the property, but you still have a conspiracy to commit robbery. So you're liable for the acts in furtherance of that conspiracy. And I know there's the Leonard analysis as well, when that harm occurs, but in my mind I thought, look, why should I bang up a guy on a felony murder robbery case when they're just throwing shots because these guys are pointing them out as perpetrators of the crime. Let's let a jury decide, did they premeditate their crime or not? And as such, the result in this case is going to be one or two things. I don't care how you instructed the jury on the Brian Rose matter. They were either going to say they premeditated it and hit him for first, or they're going to say they didn't and hit him for second, which is what happened.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Royal, rebuttal? You have 5 minutes.
There was a long discussion about the Brian Rose case, but the state could have sought a rehearing en banc in Brian Rose, and it did not do that. This forum right now is not the appropriate place to relitigate Rose. I haven't had a chance to respond to any of that argument, so if the court would like supplemental briefing on that issue, I would be happy to do so. As of right now, I'm not prepared to argue whether or not what it seemed like is that Rose should be overruled in some way. So if that is where the court is going, I would ask that we have a chance to respond with supplemental briefing. As it stands now, Rose is a controlling case. It says that when assaultive-type crimes are used as a predicate felony, that they merge into it. They cannot be the predicate felony. The state had mentioned, well, they don't really know how to charge it. They could just charge... He acted with malice aforethought, the murder statute. It was the state's decision to plead the case the way it did, with all the assaultive type felonies as the predicate offenses, with aiding and abetting the assaultive type felonies to create this new conspiracy type liability. So what you really had was 8 theories of second degree felony murder pled to the jury. That is the 3 assaultive types, aiding and abetting all 3 of those second degree felony murder, conspiracy to commit robbery as a second degree felony murder, not first degree, which, well, we argue that's really what it is. And then you have just regular second degree murder. So out of 8 theories that were presented to the jury, 7 of those were invalid. When you have 7 of 8 invalid theories, there's no way that the state now can prove that any error was harmless. I know state mentioned that, in regards to our assertion that the evidence shows that Perez was not the shooter, and they rely on the testimony of Wilmer Guevara, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but all the physical evidence points that Perez was not the shooter. The bullet recovered from the victim was from a .380, which was attributed to Ayala. Every witness said that there was only one person outside the vehicle, and that is Scott Hoover, Robert Gundlach, Wilmer Guevara. Everybody agrees that there was only one shooter outside the vehicle. Then 2 of the witnesses testify that the victim was shot during the first set of shots, that is, from the person outside the vehicle. And then there was a stop. There was no more shots. And then as the car began to drove off, that's when everybody was outside the vehicle. So Guerrero's testimony that Perez was the shooter outside does not match up to the physical evidence, nor his other testimony about how he perceived the events happen. So I think it is clear that Perez was not the shooter outside the vehicle. I think that is very important to all these theories that are going on, especially the conspiracy to commit robbery theory. And now that normally is a first degree offense. And normally you would have to prove that the killing was done in furtherance of the robbery, but the state conceded that the killing was not done in furtherance of the robbery. It was from that the argument that happened at the car, that the defendants were upset. That was the state's theory. Well, under this new theory that they've created for this case was that it doesn't have to be done in furtherance of the robbery, and if it's not done in furtherance of the robbery, then it's somehow second-degree murder because it happens during the conspiracy. Well, the state is misunderstanding the offense of conspiracy. Conspiracy is the unlawful agreement, and this court has said that. That is completed once the agreement is reached. These acts that happen afterwards, the shooting or the attempted robbery, those are all acts that could be used as evidence of the prior agreement. They are not the conspiracy. They are not the agreement. They are acts done in furtherance of the object of the conspiracy, which is separate. Conspiracy and the attempted robbery are two separate crimes. So this new theory, when you look at this case, you look at the using the secondary felony murder for assaultive type crimes, now creating it for conspiracy. And when you look at not allowing Perez his theory on self-defense and the surprise of throwing in that conspiracy theory last minute, this is a perfect case for cumulative error. I believe any one of these errors stand on its own and warrant reversal, but when you look at how all these errors intertwine, this case, this court should reverse Perez's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Royal. Thank you, Mr. Giacomo. Excellent presentation by both sides. This case will stand submitted, and we're in recess until 11:30.